Welcome to Bicom's weekly podcast. My name is James Sereen, and this week I am delighted to be joined by journalist and author Tom Segev. Tom is the author of many books about Israeli history, but I am talking to him this week about his latest book, which is a monumental biography of David Ben-Gurion. It is called A State at Any Cost, and Tom is here for the Jewish Book Week. Tom, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
I suppose the first question I wanted to ask is, why write another book about David Ben-Gurion? I mean, there's so many biographies, so many books, but you went away and you've written this monumental 684-page book about Ben-Gurion, and I'm interested to know sort of what motivated you to do that, and what do you think is the slightly different story you're telling?
The real answer is because I wanted to and because I can.
Yes.
Okay?
Good answer. Strong answer.
Yes. The last biographies of Ben-Gurion are about 30 and 40 years old, the good ones. Not that people didn't write books about Ben-Gurion. There are an endless number of books about Ben-Gurion. But in the meantime, lots of new material has been opened,
okay,
including cabinet papers, which are really, really interesting because in those days, cabinet ministers spoke under the assumption that it will never be made public. Today they talk and within 5 minutes it's on the news.
Yeah.
But in those days they have really, and so you can really follow the thoughts of people and the way they make decisions and why. And Ben-Gurion is we learn a lot from Ben-Gurion about from cabinet papers, and also his diary, which opened over the years slowly, and now it's almost all of it is open for
so
research.
So they opened that in stages.
Yes.
Recently, right.
Yes. Yes. And now it's almost all open. Not all of it. Some of it is still not open, but most of it is open, and it makes it possible to get a tri-dimensional picture, the real Ben-Gurion, and I think a better feeling for what motivated him, and that's why I thought that it's a good thing to do another book on them.
So when you
by the way, no, I just want to tell you something else. While I was doing it, four other biographies have been written about Ben-Gurion in Israel.
Yeah.
And this is in itself an interesting thing, how popular Ben-Gurion is in Israel. And I think it's connected with the very, very long term of office of Benjamin Netanyahu.
Right.
Because people associate statesmanship and vision with Ben-Gurion. And although there are some good reasons, reasonable reasons to support Netanyahu, statesmanship and vision is not really among them. And so people long for the days of Ben-Gurion as a result of the days of Netanyahu, which I think is also interesting. And so there was not a single day without Ben-Gurion mentioned in the media while I was doing that. There is a documentary film that was made on Ben-Gurion based on interviews with him. So people are calling a babysitter and going out and look for parking and buy a ticket for what? To see an interview with a politician. So this is really interesting how important Ben-Gurion has become over the years. And this is also one almost obvious reason why it occurred to me, we can do a new biography of Ben-Gurion.
One of the things I was very struck by about what you brought out is it's quite iconoclastic. I mean, certainly I almost had to chuckle a little at the early stages where it seems that Ben-Gurion, certainly as a younger politician, he seems to be left out of all the big, exciting decisions. He's constantly being left out. He's constantly trying to be more relevant, and he's being shut out by rivals, by more senior politicians. Later on, it seems he's constantly travelling, and he's not in Palestine when some of these key, you know, traumatic, consequential events are taking place. And he's also, his personal life is very chaotic. He's not very nice to his wife. He's a very complicated individual, and there's some things about it which, you know, sort of as a leader, you look at and think, well, I'm not sure if I admire some of those qualities. I mean, did you, were you conscious that you were bringing out some of these elements that make the sort of public image of him make one sort of question and think about some of that?
That's the story, which I see in the document. It's not that I cannot pretend that he was a nice man.
Yeah.
He was not a nice man. What can I do? I was asked several times, why do I need the affairs he had with other women? And the answer is that if a statesman faces a major decision, and on the same day he gets a letter from his wife who tells him that she decided to commit suicide because she learned about the affairs he has with other women, this is part of the story.
Sure, yeah.
And if he has an affair with a younger woman at the time when he is already Ben-Gurion, and he writes to her, I'm coming to Vienna to see you, but don't tell anyone.
Yes.
How can she not? How can he come to Vienna without anybody knowing? So there's a certain naivete about it, a boyish kind of mischievousness with this thing. It's not even always erotic. It's an interesting trend of character, which I think I thought is necessary to point out. The major thing, however, is that Ben-Gurion's whole personality, the core of his identity, was the Zionist ideology from a very early age on. I once went to interview him when I was very young. I was 23, he was 83. I went with two friends, we were students, and we went to interview him for our weekly newspaper of the Hebrew University students. And one of the things which surprised us very much, we were there for 3 hours. Mm. He had lots of time. He was no longer in office, so he had lots of time. He was an old man, very sad, very lonely, and one of the things which he all of a sudden told us was that he, as a boy of 3, was an ardent Zionist.
Yes. Yeah.
And we still have the tape of that conversation, and you hear one of us, me obviously, saying, Mr. Ben-Gurion, this is something you knew at the age of 3, like as if we didn't really believe what we hear. And he insisted, yes, of course, all the children, we were all Zionists. And so I thought this is a rather odd thing, and maybe he's no longer fully connected with reality. But when I did this biography, I felt, okay, not 3, but at the age of 13, he already founded a Zionist youth club, aiming at the encouragement of the Hebrew language. He wanted all people of that small town in Poland where he was born to speak Hebrew. And that was in itself an odd thing, but at least you can say that Zionism for him was really everything he had, and everything else he judged by the interests of Zionism, the way he understood it to be. And the way he understood it to be was pretty much along the lines of classical Herzl's Zionism. More specifically, he wanted a Jewish state in Palestine as early as possible, as many Jews as possible, and as few Arabs as possible, and as much land as possible, not necessarily the whole country, but as many Jews and as few Arabs.
As few Arabs in the final state.
In the final Jewish state. And that is what he was able to achieve. And the price for it was very high. And so the book, I concentrate on the price, including the moral price, which it meant, as he knew as early as, and said as early as 1919, that it will be life without peace, because peace between the Jews, Zionist Jews in Palestine, and the Arabs is impossible. This is what he said in 1919. This is over 100 years ago. That's quite amazing.
Yeah.
What he felt was that the conflict can be managed, but it cannot be solved. This is such a modern thing to say. This is what Netanyahu says today. And so it would be life without peace. That's a very high price to pay. And it involves a national tragedy for the Palestinians. And so this is not something he foresaw, but then it also involved a tragedy for a great many Jews who came to live in Israel, especially the Jews from Arab countries, but also Holocaust survivors. This was not the population he had in mind. He thought of European workers and middle-class Jews who would come to make Palestine. Jews of Europe were gone. The Holocaust survivors were weak people, both psychologically and physically, so he didn't really think that he can do much with them. And then, unwillingly, but without another alternative, the Zionist movement discovered the Jews of the Arab countries. Before the Holocaust, no one paid much attention to them. Herzl hardly knew that they existed. And so he had reason to be disappointed, because everything was much, much, much more difficult than he had thought. And it did not become a European stronghold in the Middle East as he had thought. It became a much more a society with people who were not prepared for life in a modern country, and everything was much more difficult. And so this is all in line with his feeling that the Holocaust was a crime against the State of Israel, as he had seen it in his childhood.
Just pick up on that point about the kind of Mizrahi, the Jews from Arab lands, which I think is really interesting, because Ben-Gurion was quite creative, and I think he, as you said, like many big issues, he was quite visionary. Like, he could see where the problems were and the things that needed to be done. But yeah, his obstinacy kind of kept him with this idea that really the only way to build the state was going to be Jews from Europe, and the kind of Jews that he preferred, so like the workers. And there's this bit where you bring out about how he's quite disappointed with all these German middle-class Jews coming and setting up kiosks in Tel Aviv, and these are not the people he wanted. Why did he not be more pragmatic and maybe discover that there was this kind of a whole world of Eastern Jews that could help the State of Israel? He just didn't know them.
Mizrahim from Arab countries.
I mean, you mentioned in the book that he spent a lot of time in Salonika, and he's fascinated by the Jews in Salonika.
The only ones. And then also the Yemenites. Okay. He was fascinated with Yemenites. He was fascinated with the Yemenites and the Jews in Salonika for the same reason, because they were working people.
Right.
And so they would replace Arab workers,
right,
especially the Yemenites. And so this is something he kind of never forgot, that
so
they
like
did for the Zionist. This is what you did for the Zionist dream, that you came to Palestine and receive wages which are a little bit higher than Yemenites receive, but lower than Ashkenazi workers would receive. So these were people who... Zionism is a European movement. Mm. Everything about Zionism comes from Europe. It really belongs in the history of Europe. Mm. Socialism, democracy, nationalism, secularism, it's all comes from
but he was somebody who,
from Europe. So that's the way he felt. That's the way. That's where he comes from. That's his world. No, he was not somebody who saw. Eventually, he said, "Yes, well, if we want a Jewish state, this is where we can." This is. I'm not inventing this. There's a page in his diary where it actually looks like a page of an accountant. He counts people. Where can we get them? So in Russia we can't get them. In Europe they are gone. In America they won't come. So, and then he says, Iraq, Persia, Morocco, wherever. And that's, but unwillingly. And there was a big controversy among the Zionist movement. Do we want these people or not? And he said, yes, we want everybody who can come and everybody who's willing to come, and especially after the Holocaust. So the mass immigration of the 1950s is to some extent a result of the Holocaust and the helplessness of the Zionist movement during the Holocaust. But it's also the result of the need to form a Jewish majority in Palestine. So these two things come together. It was very, very difficult, objectively difficult, to take in these people. And they were also not treated, often not treated equally with other people. They were discriminated against. There was this feeling of these are strange people. They are not ones of us. They don't belong to us. And there was a great disappointment, popular disappointment among the Ashkenazic establishment in Israel towards these people. And so part of the very, very difficult times they had could have been easier. They were so difficult because of it's a form of racism, really, looking down at them. There's no doubt about it. But it's also very difficult to build a modern state with people who have never experienced anything like that. So the combination of these two things, and all this is the price. And Ben-Gurion Zionism says a state at any price, at any cost. And this is, I think, the core of the story of Ben-Gurion and also of the state.
In terms of his, I mentioned before, like his vision, and that he was, his kind of fatalism and his obstinacy allowed him to kind of maybe see things that others didn't see early. Like he was very clear that he thought that European Jews were going to be partially destroyed. Quite early he comes to that conclusion.
Yes.
He comes very early to the conclusion that the sort of Yeshua of the community needs to build up its military capacity, and he does that. Maybe he could have done it earlier, but he certainly devotes a lot of time for that, and that certainly is very important in winning the War of Independence. But also interestingly, he's very good on the power politics. Like he understands very early how America is going to shape what happens.
Yes.
How did you feel about that? Was he more visionary in that sense that you at first realized when you approached?
No, he was visionary, but some things, didn't take much vision.
Yeah.
Hitler wrote in his newspapers that he's going to destroy the Jews. So what's the big deal here?
A lot of people didn't want to believe it.
A lot of people wanted to believe in all that, but so he did believe it. But it was not as if he knew. So he believed that Hitler means what he says.
But he's very.
So this is one thing. But the interesting thing is really about America. I mean, Ben-Gurion was exiled to America by the Ottoman authorities in 1915, and he was he spent the World War I in America, and he became a very big admirer of America. He's really the father of the Americanization of the Israeli society.
Wow.
And he introduced American concepts, mass immigration, melting pot, pioneering, Wild West, for him was the Negev, right? So all these concepts come from America, and he was able to see that Israel belongs in the American in the American world. At a time when Israeli politics still debated, do we belong under the Soviet bloc, or there was a strong leftist socialist segment of Israeli politics, and he decided, rightfully I think, that we belong in America. As part of that, he also decided that we need to establish a relationship with Germany, which I think is a major achievement of Ben-Gurion, and I'm for all for it. And so this was the controversy of orientation, as they called it. So these are things which he was able to see at the time when Chaim Weizmann, for example, still believed in the British.
Mm-hmm.
Having said that, there are a number of things which you wonder. For example, in 1956, when he believed that two sinking colonial powers, Great Britain and France, will create a new Middle East for him. That's the Suez, the war. It is very strange. How could you possibly believe that? And there are some other things which he was willing to check out as possibilities. There was no limit to his imagination. Everything we check out. For example, an idea to receive as a gift from France, French Guinea. Why do we need French Guinea? Excuse me, Mr. Prime Minister, what do you want to do with French Guinea? I don't know what he wanted to do with it, but the possibility came up. A delegation was sent there to check out. Can we settle it there or what? Completely strange things. He did strange things. He had strange thoughts, unreasonable things. He suddenly developed an interest in Buddhism and went to Burma to study Buddhism. This is a strange thing. This is an acting prime minister. Why do you go to Burma to study Buddhism all of a sudden and then come back and believe that you are an expert on Buddhism? Strange things. He consulted a fortune teller. He saw a UFO once. He did strange things, and I think that this balances a little bit this image of somebody who was all visionary and knew everything, because he also often changed his mind, and so. This is something I got from Israeli historian Anita Shapira, who also wrote a biography of Ben-Gurion of a different kind. But she once told me that Ben-Gurion wrote so much, millions and millions of words he left us, that you can find everything. Whatever you want, you will find the appropriate quote for Ben-Gurion. Whatever you want to prove, Ben-Gurion has said it once. And that's quite true, because he really constantly wrote his diary mostly. People describe that when they were sitting in a conversation with him, they never saw his eyes. They only saw his forehead all the time, because he was writing all the
and
time.
And he was a great letter writer as well.
And he was a great letter writer. Yes, there are many, many thousands of, tens of thousands of Ben-Gurion letters, yes. And he kept a copy of each one of them.
Of the ones he sent?
Yes, he wrote them hand by hand. And he had this blue carbon paper in a notebook of school notebook of children. This is also how he wrote his diary, in school notebook. And then the secretary or something would type it up or something. But there are tens of thousands of this kind of letters. And that's also interesting, because as early as the age of 20, when he first came to Palestine, he sent letters to his father and told him, keep them, because there will be a time when I want to read them and use them. So even at the age of 20, he knew that he's making history, describing history, and that's quite fascinating. So I really discovered a man who could be romantic, he could be poetic, he had these irrational transitions from deep depression to almost uncontrollable happiness. And what I appreciate particularly was a certain journalistic talent to describe people, to describe events, to see the irony of things. But having said irony, I should add immediately, he was a man who had absolutely no sense of humor. So that makes it difficult for the biographer. But he tells you lots of stories and tries to understand some larger meaning, significance of that particular story. This is when he tells you a story of something that happened to him, because he learned something from it.
Let's go back to just as a final question on the book about what you said, that this huge interest in Ben-Gurion in the recent time, and linking that to Netanyahu's longevity as a prime minister, where do you think we are in terms of Israeli political leadership? If we make a comparison between, you know, we're in an election campaign and we've got Benny Gantz and Bibi Netanyahu fighting it out, we real political paralysis in Israel. And then we look back at sort of Ben Gurion. Do you see a lot of more of the same, or do you see a
by the time you have the this is really not a fair question, because the day after tomorrow we have elections in Israel.
But it's a question about the nature of leadership.
The
nature of Israeli leadership. Was Ben Gurion something special, or was he just actually a lot of?
He was definitely special. First of all, he was not corrupt.
Yeah.
He was genuinely working for the realization of his ideology, mostly. He was a little bit corrupt, but not really very much. I mean, he bought lots of books in bookstores at Blackwell's in Oxford. And the question then came up, well, who pays for it? Mm. So it's usually the Israeli embassy who would pay for it.
And
or
he
something.
Stays in hotels and he's traveling.
Not fancy hotels. Yes. This is really interesting. In contrast to today's politicians,
yeah.
He stayed very, very modestly also among local people who...
So it was more Weizmann was the person at the time who was staying in the fancy hotels.
In the fancy hotels, yes. Yeah. Like I said, fancy hotels make me very optimistic all the time. This is a really nice saying, but this is not Ben Gurion. Ben Gurion would travel on boat in a cabin with four other people whom he doesn't know. So no, Ben Gurion was very genuine about his ideology. Politicians today are very often not following a certain ideological or clear ideological. They do everything, and so his ideology was very clear. And I think that people believed him and believed in him because they believed that he believes in himself.
Mm-hmm.
And I also believe that he did. He really believed what he was saying. He was very often very controversial, but he was always genuine. Most of what he says is genuine and can be put in some kind of ideological context, which he follows from a very early age on. Then also, I think it's unfair to compare him with today's politicians. For example, Netanyahu. When Netanyahu was born, Ben-Gurion was already prime minister. So Netanyahu found a ready-made state, which all he needs to do is to run it, while Ben-Gurion really created things from scratch. There was nothing there, and so this is a complete difference. Netanyahu several months ago celebrated an important day in his career. On that day, he was one day longer in office than Ben-Gurion. That way, he became the. This may have been the last happy occasion in his political career, but we also don't know that. Mm-hmm. But it was very important for him to point out that I am actually longer in office than Ben-Gurion was. So Ben-Gurion is a standard in Israel for integrity, for statesmanship, for vision. Even though many people were against him at the time, and some people are still today using his name as an example for things which should not have been done, either to the Arabs or to the Jews from Arab countries. But still, Ben-Gurion is a symbol of vision and integrity.
Just a final question. It's a question more about your own style, and you know you're clearly a sort of master craftsman when it comes to creating these books and taking the archives and the letters and building these incredibly readable but illuminating books around great figures or periods in history. What's the secret? Is it just working the archives, doing the hard work? Is there a particular style that you have, or a way you approach it?
A lot of it is skepticism,
right.
And I do really so much research, much more than necessary, because on the one hand, I'm willing to believe everything. On the other hand, I really need it to be documented, and I have left out several really good stories of the life of Ben-Gurion, because I can't really know if they... So I really need everything to be documented. That's why I have so many footnotes, because much of what I write is controversial and different from what other people are, because that's the way I see the story. So I'm really committed to the story. People always feel that I'm post-Zionist or anti-Zionist or too Zionist or this or that. It's not an ideology. I'm a very unideological person. I'm committed to the story. I gave a seminar some years ago at the Graduate School of Journalism of Berkeley University, and there the thesis we tried to work on was that the best history is journalistic history, and the best journalism is historic journalism. And I think I can defend that way. This is more or less the principle that leads me when I write. And I write for readers. I don't write for other professors. I've never worked I've never been a professor. I always regarded myself as a journalist, and I'm very happy to be one. And so this combination of history and journalism is something which I think directed me in my writing. This is the principle which produces these books, which many people find too journalistic, and some people find too historic, and so it's between the two.
I think it's a good mixture of both. I would say, as a reader of many of them, I think you're definitely achieving that. You're telling the very, it's a very sound look into the history, but it's also very readable, and that's a gift.
So okay.
Thank you for that, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.